Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
India recently surpassed China to become the world's largest country in population terms. India has also made headlines by refraining from supporting the Western or American position on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, despite being a member of the so-called Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue that brings together Australia, India, Japan, and the United States to talk about security issues in the Pacific region. On Ukraine, India has consistently abstained from all seven resolutions at UN bodies. It has refused to condemn Russia for the invasion. It has declined to join the West's sanctions against Moscow, and it has stepped up buying Russian fuel and other commodities at discounted prices. Despite its ties to the Quad, India also participates in other groupings such as the BRICS, which recently, of course, had its own meeting and maintains a stance generally regarded as an alternative to Western hegemony. So what's going on in India? Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies that brings scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. We're fortunate to have with us today Upendra Chowdhury, who is professor of international studies in the Department of Political Science at Aligarh Muslim University in the state of Uttar Pradesh. Professor Chowdhury received his PhD in political science from New Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University in 2000, the year 2000, with a dissertation on India's ballistic missile program. He is author of the book, Nuclear Risk Reduction Measures in South Asia, Problems and Prospects, which was published by Manohar Publications of New Delhi in 2006. He writes widely in the scholarly and popular press in India. And Professor Chowdhury has also served often as an advisor to the Indian government on educational and political issues. Thank you for joining us today, Upendra Chowdhury.
Thank you, Professor John. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thanks for taking the time to do this. So I noted in my introduction that India is playing a contradictory role in foreign affairs. As we might say here in the United States, it seems to be playing both sides of the fence. I mean, in some sense, that's the major theme I think that we want to get into this during this conversation. But what would you say is going on?
Professor John, thank you for the nice question. In India particularly, we don't use this word called sitting in the fence, free rider. So these are highly subjective and, very validated terms. In fact, in particularly so far as India's foreign policy is concerned, we always think that, there is, it's not true that there are only two sides of a conflict. There can be three sides also. And, we don't particularly accept this, that, there are, these kind of binaries are there, this side or that side. India always gives importance to the third view or third alternative, right? If two are fighting or two camps are fighting, that doesn't mean, everybody should follow this block A or block B. Rather, India always thinks that there is a need for a country or a block that can play very, stabilizing role for maintaining international peace and security. If you look at the India's foreign policy for the last 70 years, you will find that India always believed that, you know, and always also rejected that, you know, the Cold War logic that either you are with us or you are against us, right? And India proved that through its non-alignment foreign policy. So in my view, you know, we, you know, particularly India, you know, doesn't accept this, that, you know, either you are in this side or you are in that side. Rather, India thinks that it plays a very positive kind of role, you know, stabilizing kind of role, so far as its foreign policy is concerned. If you look at the US foreign policy, you know, particularly, you know, I particularly personally think that, you know, it has become very difficult for the USA policymakers to understand India's non-aligned policy. And they always think that, you know, it's a kind of fence-sitting. So, you know, India doesn't accept this kind of view. Rather, it thinks that it plays a very positive kind of role. If there are conflicts between two sides, you need a third side to play a stabilizing and peaceful role.
Yes, I mean, I can certainly understand that. But I guess part of the issue is that it increasingly seems as though we're facing a kind of, if you like, a new Cold War kind of situation in which, you know, you're either on one side or the other. You're either on the American or the Western side, or you're on the Chinese side, I think, primarily. And, you know, that's, it seems to me, increasingly the way this, you know, the world situation is being viewed by the two major players. Now, you could say that India is, you know, increasingly a major player, but it's not really in the same league just yet, it seems to me, as the United States and China. So India, in a way, seems like a kind of a swing state, a term I heard John Eikenberry use in an interview the other day, which I had not heard before. That is to say, it's a state that, you know, will side with one side in on certain issues and the other side, you know, assuming there are such things as sides, as you say, India will, you know, will side with one side at certain times and the other side at other times. I mean, is that basically what you're saying? Is India is a kind of a swing state and can't, you know, be expected to necessarily have this, you know, unidirectional sort of view of the world situation and has different interests in different contexts?
Yeah, you can say India is a swing state, but, you know, that not in a very opportunist sense. Suppose I would give one instance that India, you know, is a member of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's a member of BRIC country, you know, BRIC group. It's also a member of Quad and I2U2. But, you know, they, you know, by becoming a member of this, you know, it seems that they are quite, you know, contradictory groups or different groups with different objectives. But if you go to the deeper, you will find that, you know, they serve lots of interest, including the interest of international community. You know, if India is a member of SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, it is there to, you know, not to allow Russia to be very close to China. And secondly, it is there in Shanghai Cooperation Organization because it has a lot of interest in Central Asian countries. And India also believes that if it is a member of Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it can counter its adversaries like Pakistan and China. So if India is a member of Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in a way it serves a very stabilizing kind of role because you can counter China, because China has always a very kind of, you know, it always tried to, you know, play an important role in Asia, and it also tries to manipulate the kind of order that we are planning to have in Asia. So if India is there in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it is in a way to counter, you know, China, and also, you know, not to allow the Central Asian countries or even, you know, have some kind of leverage for Russia not to be closely aligned with China. If it is a member of BRIC, you know, you will also find that, you know, India thinks that, you know, if India is not in the BRICS, then that BRICS will be manipulated by China, which has a very imperialistic kind of, you know, thinking about the current world order, that it although it believes in a multipolar world, but it believes that, you know, that multipolar world should be with Chinese characteristics. So in order to counter this kind of hegemonic Chinese interests. So India is a member of ASEO and BRICS. At the same time, India also believes that, you know, if it is there in ASEO and BRICS to counter the totalitarian China, at the same time, it is also a member of Quad and I2U2, where it is aligned with democratic countries like Japan, like United States, like Australia, and because they all share the vision to make the Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific, what you call now, you know, a stable kind of order where there is no domination by China, and, you know, there is a lot of freeness for trade, for maritime security, for humanitarian disaster-related activities. So basically, India is in the ASEO to counter, China, in the BRIC to not to allow the BRIC forum to be manipulated by China. At the same time, India also shares a lot of interest to the democratic countries like United States, you know, Australia and Japan. So it seems from the surface that these, India's membership in these organizations are somehow contradictory. But if you go to the deep, you will find that they are not actually contradictory. Rather, these all, forums, they are there. And India is a member of all these forums, not to allow these forums to be turned as a anti-Western group, as the Chinese are trying to do.
Right. So, I mean, all the discussion of China reminds me of, something that we talked about before, and namely, India's particular interest in regard to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, in the matter of national sovereignty. And I mean, India and China share a border for, a certain stretch of the border. And there's, there are border disputes between India and China, and India has traditionally been a strong supporter of, the idea of national sovereignty, in part as a result of this background. So are you, surprised or puzzled that they haven't been more critical of the Chinese with regard to the, its support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Or is that just sort of one of the kinds of things that India takes in stride, given its kind of swing state position in these discussions?
Yeah, India has been very consistent about its position in the United Nations so far as the Russia-Ukraine war is concerned. It abstained from any kind of resolution that condemned Russia. But at the same time, India also, played an important role in pressing the United Nations to invite Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, to address the United Nations Security Council and General Assembly by a video link. And it also, provided humanitarian, it was one of the first countries to provide humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. And at the same time, it also condemned Russia for the Bucha killings. And you'll also, find it interesting that Indian Prime Minister, who meets, Putin annually through a Russia-India dialogue, he did not go to Russia to meet Putin because Russia was threatening to attack Ukraine through nuclear weapons. So, India is always trying to balance its position vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine. If you look at the initial stages of the war, you'll find about 22,500 Indian students were in Ukraine. It needed the support of both Russia and Ukraine to evacuate those students. So a country which has a lot, lots of interest in Ukraine and Russia, it cannot immediately be, critical of all these, all these two countries because the United States wanted to, impose sanctions or take a position against Russia. And secondly, if you look at the sanctions, you will find that, India was not consulted by the West or particularly the United States while imposing sanctions. India always imposed, India always opposed the unilateral sanctions by any countries. If the sanctions are imposed by the United Nations, India would have been happy to follow it. But there is a, feeling in India that, you cannot unilaterally impose the sanctions and expect other countries to fall in line. And if you don't do that, then you argue that you are a fence sitter or a free rider. So that is India's perception. But behind the scene, India is also playing a very stabilizing kind of role vis-a-vis the Russia-Ukraine conflict is concerned. You know, when in September 2022, you know, there was a Black Sea grain deal, with the mediation of Turkey and United Nations, India was the country that played a behind the scene kind of role in persuading Russia to respect that grain deal. And even the Delhi G20 summit, you know, India is trying to, play a major role in coming with a consensus document that takes into account the Western, arguments vis-a-vis the Chinese and Russian arguments. So you need a kind of, mediator country, or you need a kind of stabilizing force. You know, if everybody is fighting with everybody, you need at least a country that can play a peaceful role, a kind of role that is really stabilizing for the world order. So that is basically India's position. And India, you know, the Indian Prime Minister, he talked to the Ukraine president, he has talked to the American president on the Russia-Ukraine war, he talked to the Russian president. And, you know, when Russia was, Russia was attacking the important nuclear plant in Ukraine, then, you know, it was India that discouraged and that pressurized Putin not to use nuclear weapons or even use the threat of nuclear weapons against Ukraine. So these things, these things are not known. And India doesn't like to advertise its peaceful kind of role that it is playing between Russia and Ukraine. So, So India is a country, that is basically, not advertising for its kind of role that we are doing. Look, we are doing this, we are doing that. So it's whatever it's doing, it's doing a kind of role that is peaceful, that is in a way stabilizing. And India is also supporting this argument that, for example, Russia has annexed Ukrainian territory. India has not accepted that annexation of territory by Russia. Russia has taken Crimea. India has not recognized that. So we have to accept this also. India condemned Russia for its Bucha killings. So, and India abstained when Russia tried to, use a resolution for humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. So the world must know these kind of roles also. If India is abstained on American or West-led UN resolution that is publicized, but if India is abstained or condemning Russia, or Indian Prime Minister even talked to Putin that, today's era is not a kind of war which you are using to alter the boundaries. So India, in many ways, respected the territorial sovereignty and, sovereignty of Ukraine.
Right. So, I mean, maybe what might be helpful is for you to talk a little bit about, India's kind of self-understanding in the current context. I mean, this, moment when India seems to have surpassed in population terms, its neighbor China, which, is powerful in other ways besides demographic ways, in economic terms and military terms, in ways that, arguably India hasn't entirely attained at this point. And so one wonders as an outsider and a non-expert, what exactly is going on in India in terms of its self-understanding and its, obviously to talk about a country with 1.4 million people, having any specific aspiration is, perhaps a little absurd, but maybe you could talk about what you think the Indian population wants to see as far as, where the country is going to go in the future. I mean, in general, the kinds of developments that we're talking about, including, for example, BRICS, is a kind of sense that American power is in relative decline. Everybody was looking at China until pretty recently when concerns about the economy and about the, age structure of the population began to become more prominent and that sort of thing. So, how does India see its future in the coming, decades?
Okay. As far as India's future international role is concerned, there are three kinds of debate, domestic debate in India. You know, the first, you know, debate revolves around this, those who argue that strength respects strength and power respects power. So they argue that India should acquire, you know, military capability, economic capability, you know, scientific capability, space capability. You know, India should acquire all dimensions of what we call comprehensive national power, so that, you know, it will be respected both by the United States, Europe, China, Russia, everybody. So because everybody respects, you know, power. You know, if you look at India's nuclear test, you know, before 1998 nuclear test, India was not taken very seriously by the United States. So once it conducted the nuclear test, you know, it was taken seriously by the United States. So there is an argument that, you know, since power respects power and strength respects strength, so India should try to acquire more and more power. And for acquiring that power, if it needs the friendship and, you know, and cooperation with the United States, that is perfectly fine. So this is one school of argument. The second school thinks that, you know, India should not, you know, aspire for power because, you know, we argue that in international politics, we argue that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if you look at the history of rising powers, you know, once you have you acquire power, you become more arrogant, right? You always engage in, you know, mad mutual assured destruction. You always accumulate more and more nuclear weapons. Then you spend a lot of money to destroy those nuclear weapons. Then, you know, you become arrogant. You engage in arms race. You go for all kinds of alliances. So that shows that if you become more powerful, you will be more arrogant. So that is the second school. And they conclude that, you know, if you want to really have a mark, so you should be, you know, be a good power. You should be a benevolent power. Rather, you should, you know, you should give others example. You know, that is the power of your example. And instead of focusing on international, you know, relations and acquiring more and more power, rather you should focus on India's domestic challenges. So, you know, poverty, unemployment, malnutrition. There are so many problems. So, second school argues that, you know, instead of acquiring more and more power, rather you should focus on internal challenges, and you do play an international role that is definitely, you know, a stabilizing kind of role, but at the same time you address the, you know, domestic challenges. There is also a third school that believes that, you know, the whole concept of India as a rising power is just a Western construct. You know, they want to take advantage of India's big market. You know, they want to get India's cooperation in containing China. So there is a third view. But if you look at the current Indian government's policy position, you will find that, you know, India is giving a lot of importance to acquiring comprehensive national power. And at the same time, India thinks that, you know, it is not just, you know, a country you can limit it to a swing state. Rather, India consider itself as a pillar of international, you know, security, international peace. So it consider it as a unique sense of entitlement, you know, because of its ancient civilization, because of its, you know, rule as a Vishwaguru. So what you can think is, you know, basically those who argue in this line, they focus that India should acquire power, but at the same time, India should also be concerned about the domestic challenges. And at the same time, India's perception of, you know, India is in favor of a multipolarity. And if you look at the United States, China, and India, there's a lot of difference on this multipolarity. You know, if you look at America, you know, America is in favor of a unipolar world and a multipolar Asia, right? And if you look at the Chinese, you will find that Chinese are in favor of a multipolar world, but unipolar Asia dominated by the Chinese. But India is a country that looks and supports a multipolar world with multipolar Asia. So India doesn't think that, you know, the world should be bipolar, world should be unipolar. Rather, India considers itself as one of the important poles of this multipolar world. And India is also a supporter of the current liberal international order, because India, the only question is, you know, India thinks that it is not getting the kind of justice, the kind of, you know, stature, the kind of importance in the current international order, because this was devised at a time when India was not even independent. And the, you know, this Western order is basically built on a position that gives undue importance to many of the countries who are even, you know, not at par with the current India's GDP. You know, see a country like France, see a country like UK. So they are, in economic terms, they are standing nowhere, but they are all permanent members of the UN Security Council. So India has a lot of grievances against the current international order, but India is not in favor of overthrowing this order. Rather, India wants to reform rather than to replace this international order.
Interesting. So I guess one question that occurs to me in reaction to what you've been saying, and that is, you know, that I talked in framing the last question about India's size and the 1.4 billion people. But all those people don't share necessarily the same worldviews. And, you know, particularly I have in mind the religious divide with which Prime Minister Narendra Modi is, of course, problematically connected, going back to his days as chief of state in, I think it was Gujarat. And, you know, violence against Muslims that he seems to have allowed to happen or condoned. I mean, there's obviously a debate about this, but, you know, I guess the question is to what extent, I mean, India is famously the world's largest Muslim country, even though it's, you know, dominated.
Second largest after Indonesia. So India, you know, is the second largest Muslim country after Indonesia.
I thought it was actually bigger than Indonesia, but okay, I stand corrected. But in any case, it has a very large Muslim population, which has, you know, been historically a source of division within the, you know, Indian state. So, you know, how does that play out? How does that affect India's stance in regard to world affairs and the international order?
Yeah, thank you for your question. You know, India, it's basically a very diverse country in terms of language, in terms of culture, in terms of religion. And India has always been a federal country, right? In terms of, you know, I'm not talking of political federalism. Rather, you know, if you look at different cultures, different languages, different regions, India has always believed in what we call Salad Bowl approach, right? So every culture should be there, every religion should be there. And India was basically trying to, you know, in India, it's not just a geographical kind of thinking, you know, it's a kind of psychological, you know, thinking that, you know, all cultures should flourish, all languages should flourish. And India was federal, India is federal, and India's future lies with a federal kind of arrangement. You know, it's not a question of Muslims, Hindus, Christians, or Sikhs, rather. All, you know, if India wants to play a larger international role, it should unite the diverse cultures, you know, diverse religions. If you just favor one culture, one religion over the other, you know, in that way India is not going to play any important kind of role. So, you know, if, you know, there are aberrations, there are short-term problems, but, you know, if you look at India's history, if you look at India's culture, India has always been, you know, a kind of federal arrangement for the prosperity, for the benefit of all cultures, all religions. And India acted as a glue. If you look at the India-China war in 1962 or India-Pakistan war in 1965 or 1971, even the Kargil war of 1999, you will find that all Indians, despite their religious differences, cultural differences, regional differences, they got united. And one interesting example I would cite, I think most of the people outside India may not be knowing that, you know, India is a country of you know, 1.4 billion or 140 crore people, 1.4 billion, you know, people. But, and the 80% of the population are Hindus. But if you look at India's, you know, democracy, you will find that at time, India, despite being a, you know, Hindu-dominated country, you can say 80% of the population was Hindu. One time, the prime minister was a Sikh, was not a Hindu. The president was a Muslim. And the lady who was more powerful than the prime minister was a Christian. I'm talking of Sonia Gandhi. I'm talking of Manmohan Singh. I'm talking of Abdul Kalam Azad, APJ Abdul Kalam. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, that only happened in India. You know, 80% of the people are Hindus, but you know, at a time you find one Christian lady was controlling the prime minister. The prime minister himself was from a Sikh community, a minor community or a minority community in India, and the president was from the Muslim community. So India had that kind of, you know, given that kind of example. But yes, I agree that in case India wants to play a larger international role, you know, it has to, you know, be a multicultural, multi, you know, religious country. You know, you can't impose anything, or you have to take care of each community's legitimate needs, legitimate, you know, grievances, and you should address those grievances within the framework of Indian constitution.
Well, there's no question that India is a complicated and fascinating place, and we're going to have to keep an eye on it in the years to come to see where it goes in these various respects. And I really appreciate your insights. That's it for today's episode. I want to thank Upendra Chaudhary for sharing his insights about Indian politics and foreign policy in the contemporary world. Look for us on the New Books Network, and remember to subscribe and rate International Horizons on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I want to thank Osvaldo Mena Aguilar for his technical assistance, as well as to acknowledge Duncan McKay for sharing his song International Horizons as the theme music for the show. This is John Torpy saying thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having with us for the next episode of International Horizons.
Thank you, John. It was really a pleasure.